Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And on our way to this conversation, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper for the last 80 years. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. Belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. We're going to take a look at Syria in the beginning of this program here, in this first part of our hour, and what's been going on there. We saw the Russian ambassador was shot and killed by a Turkish police officer screaming out the words of remembering Syria and Aleppo. And we see the scenes in Aleppo, and we've also watched, I think, in many ways, people contorting themselves over what the response should be. Whether it's people on the left contorting themselves saying, oh, well, you know, we should be supporting Assad, or in part because the West is anti-Assad. Whether you see people wringing their hands because they don't know how to respond. President Barack Obama had a press conference just the other day where he spoke about the difficulty of responding to Syria, both in terms of the politics between his presidency and the U.S. Congress, the reality that most Americans do not want to get re-embroiled in another Middle Eastern country in a war. And we saw what happened in Iraq and have seen now what's happening in Afghanistan. And it's very difficult. But then you watch the scenes of people who are being slaughtered, where over half the country are either refugees internally or externally in Syria at this moment, and fears of a massacre and slaughter that could take place in Aleppo. Also, if you have time, we'll cover a little bit about what Aleppo and Mosul mean. These two cities, when you look at the history of the world and the Middle East, these two cities are kind of the source of the multicultural heritage of that region and who we are as a Western culture, both those cities. And so this is a very telling moment. And we're here with somebody I've just met and two people who I have huge respect for who've been on the show many times. Dr. Tabit Abdullah is an associate professor of Middle East history, associate at York University, Toronto, author of numerous books, was born in Iraq, lived in Syria, joins us again here today. Tabit, great to have you back on the air with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Dr. Adil Shamu is with us. Adil is an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, senior analyst for Foreign Policy and Focused, also a noted author and was born in Iraq and lived in Iraq and now, of course, is here in America. Adil, good to have you with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And Sean McFessel is with us in studio. Sean McFessel is author of Nonviolence Ain't What It Used to Be, Unarmed Insurrection and the Rhetoric of Resistance. We'll be talking about a little bit at the end of the program here. He's professor of English at Highline College in Seattle. And he lived in Syria before the war and visited the area recently and was also on the border when the three Americans were taken by Iran. But he happened not to go on that hike that day, so did not get arrested by the Iranians. And and he's very happy. I think he didn't go hiking that day. Good to have you in the studio, Sean. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talkatsteinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages, but do join us. And Tabit, let me begin with you. If I might. I mean, this is, you know, you joke that you wish you could come on the show sometimes and talk about something a little more lighthearted.
there are things about the Middle East which are not all disasters.
Exactly. Well, it's true. There's such depth of beauty in the Middle East. And one of those places was, many people talk about and things I've read. I've not been there, though. At least you may have been there, Tabit, and you have been there, Sean. But, I mean, Aleppo was one of those cities, an ancient city, a vibrant city. I mean, talk a bit about what the consequences of this means for you.
Oh, my God, where can I begin? Aleppo is truly one of the most beautiful places in the world. It's the city itself, I mean, just reeks of culture and depth and something very ancient and original. It was always a very vibrant commercial center going back to the beginnings of civilization. It was always a meeting place for ideas as well. And it was there that many of the leading religions, especially Christianity and Islam, were in many ways defined. I mean, what we know as Christianity today evolved, of course, and Aleppo and the region of Aleppo was an extremely important center where the ideas that formed the Christianity, especially the Western Christianity, the Christianity that went to the Roman Empire and then from there to Europe, it had much of its roots in the region of Aleppo. I can go on and on. And in modern history, Aleppo was a bastion, really, of the new hopeful Middle East, especially a center of Arab nationalism and a view toward a modernized Middle East.
And Sean, before I turn to Adel, you've spent time in Aleppo as well, right?
Yeah, I was based out. I was actually based in a Palestinian camp outside of Damascus when I was there, mostly as an Arabic student. But I definitely visited Aleppo a number of times, and I can only reiterate what Thabit said. It's just a really original is really a good word for it. It had this kind of vibe. It has this intellectual vivacity and kind of independence. It's actually, I think, sort of in the past already been besieged and survived like, you know, something like 60 times in its history or something.
Right. The Crusades and more. And right, exactly.
So continuing all along. Right. I think it was on the Silk Road, if I'm not
it
correct.
It was. Correct, yes.
And just it's been a real cultural center. And it's just in, I mean, of course, you know, historically as a city, this is a unfathomable loss. And then in terms of the sort of the history, in a lot of ways, really the end, I think, I hope not. We'll see what happens. But in some sense, it seems like the end of the Syrian revolution that we've been seeing for 5 or 6 years, which began with such noble aims. And I think in a lot of ways, those have persisted throughout. But I think with the fall of Aleppo, we really see the kind of loss of any kind of land base, with the exception of the Idlib area, which is less strategically important and more rural. There's no major city in Idlib. It's kind of the loss of those ideals and the confirmation of this, you know, that states can kind of do this to their own populations, and it's just kind of fine with the world.
And Adel, your perspective on this too, and I'm interested in your perspective both as an analyst of the Middle East, but as someone who is part of the ancient Christian tradition that you grew up in Iraq, which is attached to Aleppo in many ways. So please go ahead.
Yeah, I'm disadvantaged. I don't have a personal experience in Aleppo, but Aleppo, I'll speak on modern times,
yes,
is really an industrial city. That's why it became the largest city in Syria. So their connection to the West and technology and modern culture and literature is because of the nature of large cities and the interaction among them. And of course, was very much in the minds of the Iraqis all the time. Of course, Damascus comes first and Aleppo comes second to that. So that's the kind of city it is.
It was until very recently the third largest city in the Ottoman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And a major center where all the trading companies from Europe had offices. It was far more important than Damascus until modern times, when Damascus became the political capital.
So when you look at where we are now, this Syrian revolution began 5 years ago with the nonviolent demonstrations in the streets. And then, of course, there were some armed protection of those nonviolent demonstrators when they were viciously attacked by the Syrian police and army. But that notwithstanding, what we've seen unfolding here, I think that when you look at what happened 16 years ago or so with the invasion of Iraq, attacking Afghanistan, the Gulf War that happened before that, and that I think that the West in many ways, Adel, doesn't know how to respond. You know, either militarily, should that be an option? Is that an option? Or humanitarianly, as a humanitarian cause, how do you even intervene when this is happening and you have no way of protecting these hundreds of thousands of people who are being victimized and killed and raped and hurt in this war?
Well, I think we need to admit that the Middle East, including Syria's issues and Iraq's issue, is a very complex issue. The West was very surprised with the Arab Spring. The liberation movement were coming into Egypt, Tunisia, even Iraq, and Syria, Yemen, and they had to find, in my way, a solution of how to curb that revolution, and of course, it scares the hell out of the Saudis and the Qataris, and. So I think in the very first year, the revolution in Syria was true revolution. People, nationalist Syrians, against thug Bashar al-Assad, and so the money, billions of dollars of the Saudis and Qatari poured into Syria. We had a special ops in Syria within a few months of the start of that revolution. And all hell broke loose, and now we have hundreds of groups from terrorists to real nationalist liberation people, and they are fighting all over, and all ethnic background and religious background. It's a very complex and it's very sad story of how we interfere. Really, we interfere through Saudi Arabia. That's what we are doing in Yemen, by pumping all the machinery, the military machineries we have, and the Saudis pay for it, and we put a naval huge ship on the shores of Yemen to provide intelligence as well as armor and bombing sometimes in Yemen. It's part of that mosaic of maintaining control in the Middle East for a variety of reasons. We have talked about it many times.
Are you about to say what, Sean?
Well, there's a lot to talk about here. I think I'm not sure I entirely disagree. I agree that all of those things are happening, but the priority and the order that those things came in and the sort of causal relationship, I'm not entirely agreed on, because I think we saw before the widespread, you know, any kind of influence of the Gulf states and, you know, the those sort of cultural influences that came in that pushed the struggle into kind of the military terrain. We saw a very clear, as you were saying, Mark, we saw brutal repression, use of torture and use of massacring protests, for example, in Homs and everything that kind of forced people to take up arms in self-defense. And I think in some sense, under the pressure of the regime's repression of the original nonviolent movement, it didn't leave a lot of other options. And I think that was I hear this really consistently with journalists and activists that I talked to in the region, that was the plan. I read recently that a report came out that was sort of leaked, where some of the internal security forces were referencing the history of the Algerian Revolution, and that they were sort of saying
Syrian security forces you're talking about.
I'm saying this, yeah, the Syrian security
internal
forces
security, right,
within
sure,
the beginning
right,
of the
right.
of the Syrian revolution, were referencing what happened with the Algerian Revolution, where you basically squeeze out, you invalidate the elections, you squeeze out, you kind of narrow the channels of response into desperation. And then, when you have people come out and protest and do these sort of things that people would do first, you brutally repress them, you kind of spread resentment and terror among people. And so you kind of force a brutal response with your brutal oppression. And then they knew that that would have an invalidating effect. And of course, Assad had also fostered a lot of these sort of jihadist groups to undercut the Americans in Iraq. He invited those back in. Famously, he released, this was very public, he released some hundreds of prisoners from Saydnaya prison who'd been kind of the, the radical factions of the Brotherhood and other Islamist groups, and encouraged them to join the protests early on. So
I actually witnessed this. When I was in Syria, when the Americans went into Iraq, the Assad regime actively encouraged the Islamists. In fact, one time I was in the center of the city, and there was a big demonstration of Islamists, and the security forces did not intervene. They basically ushered them into buses, sending them to Iraq, and which is where they became even more radicalized. They became better trained with arms and so on. Then they came back to Syria. It's a really very sad story.
So given that, What is, I mean, and I know at the top, I know you're often loath to kind of say what the Americans should do since you have your hands full with the Middle East, Iraq, and being a Canadian now as well.
Especially now that you have Trump. I mean, it was bad enough before.
But what is a response from the West here? I mean, that's something I think that people are really battling. You see, I said this in the beginning of the program.
Look, I agree completely with what has been said, that there was a democratic movement in Syria. The response of the regime was well calculated, incredibly brutal, but it drove the anti-government forces into the hands of these fascistic groups, the Islamists, and polarized the country to such an extent where it's become practically impossible for freedom-loving Syrians to side anymore with the option of overthrowing the regime. That has become a difficult position as a result of the tactics of the regime. I mean, before I say, you know, what's to be done, let's just put this into perspective here. There's over 500,000 people that have been killed in Syria. There are nearly 12 million refugees. That's a gigantic number when one considers that the country is just around 23 or 25 million. So practically half the population have either become refugees abroad or more commonly internal refugees. One half of the country is outside any kind of government control. The inflation rate is running at 400%. There's international sanctions that have compounded the whole issue. Two-thirds of the population of Syria now live in extreme poverty, not poverty, but extreme poverty, on the verge of starvation. When one considers all of this, along with the political powers that exist, I mean, you have the dictatorship of Assad on the one hand, supported by a narrow sectarian base, and you have the main opposition. And let's not fool ourselves, really. I think that the democratic elements within the Syrian opposition have become so weak as to almost be irrelevant now. It's primarily the extremist Islamist groups. When one considers these kind of options, along with the disastrous humanitarian situation that I've just underlined, I don't think there are many options that would lead to any kind of short-term relief, other than a massive sort of international military intervention, which will not happen. I dread this, but I think that the Syrian conflict is going to continue for many, many more years. I don't think that that Assad's taking of Aleppo is going to calm things down. He might actually succeed in having sort of nominal control over the country, but the insurgency, I think, will continue in an underground or secretive fashion. And I think the situation is going to be disastrous for a long time. If I was to make a suggestion as to policies, and I'm always loath to do so.
Right, I know, right.
Yeah, but if I was, I think that the sanctions should be lifted. As much as it pains me, because all my life I have fought against these Ba'athist thugs that have ruled over both Syria and Iraq, I think the extent of the humanitarian suffering is to such a position that I don't think it would be wise for the international community to continue talking about overthrowing the Assad regime and putting international sanctions and so forth in order to destabilize the regime. I think that's now become really disastrous.
So I'm sorry, Tabit.
Sorry. Yeah, that's my opinion.
No, that's you said a lot, a great deal here. And let me pick up on the final point, come back to the beginning here, before I turn to Sean. Adil, I know you are not loath to talk about what you think American policy should be, because that's what you do. So what, in response to what Tabit said, what possible response could there be?
Well, let me just add to what Tabit said. the interference of the West in affairs of the Middle East, to me, the most glaring example, I won't go into detail, is the invasion of Iraq. Totally made up, totally, et cetera, and killing nearly 500,000, among other things. But that is really the reason. The West looks for a weak dictator or, you know, the ripe apple on the tree to pick it up. And Saddam was a ripe apple on the tree, and of course, Bashar al-Assad was too. So now move forward with the current humanitarian disaster in Syria. I personally think the UN, under the UN, which is not a good place to start, under the banner of the United Nations, there should be an interference, because now the conditions have deteriorated so much that there is a wholesale killing, wholesale slaughter, wholesale the most saddest situation in Middle East. It's really, Syria is worse than Iraq used to be after the invasion. So, yeah, I would support some kind of a UN force. By the way, that was in the first year I actually suggested that, with conditions that they follow the path to democracy. It's a fantasy of mine, and go on control. And however, we may have third war if we do that.
So I think let's just break roll until we take the real break, and we'll just keep rolling. Is that cool? I just want to double check before we go. We're going to keep this rolling until we take the actual break to talk a bit about Sean's book at the end of the program. Okay, so let's just keep this rolling. We'll take a break later on. Unless you all want to take a break now, let me know. Are we taking a break? Okay. The directors across class say take the break now. We'll take a break now and come right back with our guests. Want your thoughts about Syria at 410-319-8888. What is the West to do? What are we to do for Syria and Syrians? Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. As we explore Syria, where the world is now is Syria, where Syria is, and it's a very emotional time, I think, for many of us covering this. At least I will say that just a point of personal pain is the numbers of people I have in my world that both are Syrian and Iraqi who are living through with these times right now, and seeing how we, the West, have played a role in blowing up their world. And now we watch these scenes of utter fear and devastation among so many in Syria. And as I think Tabit Abdullah so eloquently put, it's almost between a rock and a hard place about what the world can really do and where it can move. And we're here with Tabit Abdullah, Dr. Tabit Abdullah, Dr. Adel Shamu, and Sean McFessel. And Sean, you wanted to weigh in on what you just heard, so please go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what's said. I think there's obviously no easy... easy solutions for the greater problem. I think it's interesting in some ways the parallels with the Israel-Palestine situation, and often you find the same parties having sort of opposite stances. But I see a lot of parallels with those. That the long-term solution is going to be very complicated and such, but it doesn't necessarily mean that in the short term that our responses aren't so obvious. So even if the long-term complexities and how we're going to bring peace and reconciliation. In our place in that to Syria, I think there's things that we can sort of decide on. One thing with every Syrian that I've met, I'm also working on a documentary, and this has been everybody I've interviewed for that, and I've had a lot of friends who've worked in refugee camps, you know, in Greece and along the sort of refugee column that's going into Europe. And I always ask my friends, you know, have you met a single, out of the thousands of Syrians you've worked with and you've kind of talked to about this, have you ever met somebody who is like, you know, it's just so messed up at this point, I wish Assad would just kind of restore order so we could go back to our lives? And my friends always laugh and they said they've never met a single Syrian who said that. I have the same experience, you know. You'd think, like, I certainly meet Iraqis who've like said, you know, the rule under Saddam Hussein was horrible in many ways, but at least we had a functional country and now we have a security nightmare, or, you know. But I've never met a Syrian, at least who wasn't employed currently by the government, who's said that. And the line that I keep hearing from people is that, of course, Syria before the war, like when I was living there 2008-2009, I calculated some numbers and saw that it's actually the largest sort of secret security police force as a portion of the population, it's the largest it's ever existed in history. So it was a beautiful, when I was there, it was a beautiful place. I met all these just really amazing people, but it was definitely an oppressive environment for Syrians. And people, now that they've kind of broken that, they're just not willing to go back, especially, assumably, it's going to be worse. So I think when I've asked people, you know, we could start from the refugee situation, since we're talking about half of the population being displaced and maybe a third outside the country. Unanimously, I've heard from every Syrian I've talked to, when I say, what would it take to go back? The first thing they say is Assad out. So I think any language where we speak of this as of this regime as the government of Syria, it's not. I think by this point, that's not how Syrians are talking about it. So I think we have to recognize that in our solution. A couple other things that I think we have to recognize in our framing before we talk about the solution is that as much as of course it's true that the opposition. And I think it's important to make a distinction between the opposition and the revolution. The opposition, you know, of course, is heavily influenced by foreign interests that, particularly from the Gulf and Turkey, and to some smaller extent from the U.S. The revolution itself has kind of persisted. That a lot of these, you know, this amazing explosion of civil societies in the worst of conditions still continues now. You still have local coordinating councils and a lot of towns that are having, you know, that are meeting and trying to make things work. So you have this space of civil society that's been opened up as early as 2011 when the regime was driven out of areas that persists. And you have, I think the majority of Syrians still are passionately sort of democratic and would be able to, you know, take over running their country. I just don't think, I don't know that easy way to get that into their hands.
So let me pursue what you just said, Sean, in a way, and go to Adil and then go to Tabit and come back here in the studio. One of the issues, it seems to me, I mean, I think people don't, especially many Americans, don't realize the depth and powerful nature of the cosmopolitan culture that exists in the Arab world. Whether we're talking about Tripoli, Cairo, Baghdad, Aleppo, Mosul, you name the city that's older than anything we have anywhere close in Europe or America in terms of a culture and a community, and really forward-thinking people who have taken the ancientness of where they are and married and blended it with the modern nature of their international reactions with the world from the Ottomans and beyond and more. It's just setting that up to say that, but what's happened here is that in Iraq, in some ways in Syria, in Afghanistan, in Libya, the overthrow of the people that we considered brutal dictators has led to nothing but chaos because they've been external interventions. So, I mean, so then again, I'm saying that to tag on what Sean said. So then, what, given Sean's analysis, whether you agree or disagree, where does that take that? I'll let Sean once again. Sean was desperate to get back to you, but Adil, let me let you jump in here.
Well, the external force was did not have goodwill of the people. All they wanted is to control it politically and militarily and install basically a puppet government. And that's really the history of Middle East. And that's the same thing happened in Syria. Syria, in the first year, there were many people. I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm defending a thug. Many people supported Assad, not the majority by any means, but I would easily say 30-35% of the population, all the minorities, they were fearful of slaughter by the other groups, as a matter of fact. That all now is gone by the wayside, and all of them, they would want some respite from anybody who can bring some resemblance of peace in Syria in order to survive. And that's, I'm so pessimistic, I'm a pessimist when it comes to Middle East. I don't see anything on the horizon, especially now with Russia having really a strong foot in Syria, and I don't think they're going to give it away easily just because the United States growl on them.
And I think
they're not going to go away.
And I think Tabit, the Russian aspect is, and we really haven't talked about it before, on our way back to hearing Sean's thoughts, is within what a question I asked, the Russians aren't going anywhere, and they have established a huge presence that could redefine things in ways Americans will have absolutely no control over, whether it's Trump or Obama or anybody else.
Yes, yes. I mean, just a very quick note before I address that concerning Sean's statement about, you know, nobody, no Syrian would support. I said I know that he's unpopular, and I loathe this regime, but I strongly disagree. I mean, I know that there are many Syrians, especially Christians and Alawis, and these are not insignificant in number, who today would who are basically forming the backbone of his forces there, and fighting to the end to keep. Keep his regime in power, because they know that the alternative will be wholesale slaughter for them. And I don't think that's an unreasonable assumption on their part. Now, concerning Russia's involvement, I think what especially the Aleppo situation really has pointed out is the end of the illusion of a unipolar world. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War, there was an attempt. And the greatest manifestation of that attempt was the American invasion of Iraq. But the attempt by the United States to be the sole power in the world. I think the whole Syrian civil war has shown the failure of the United States in establishing a unipolar world. It's also damaged the European Union. It's destroyed its internal borders. And it's given a major boost to right-wing politics all over the Western world, which are not only directed against immigrants. I mean, that's the main thing. But it's going to cost democracy in Europe and in North America. Russia has really challenged, I think, very effectively the U.S. attempt at establishing a unipolar world in Syria. I have spoken to an advisor to Gorbachev, who told me that after what happened in Libya, there was a crisis within the Russian government, and they vowed that they would draw a red line in Syria, that they would absolutely not allow what happened in Libya to happen again in Syria, because they don't trust the United States' intentions.
And well, we lied to them.
They've been very successful on that.
So, and I'll let you jump back in, Adel, but let me let Sean wants to jump through the mic as well. Then I'll come right back to you, Adel. Sean?
Sure.
Let me just jump in with a clarifying point. I was just saying that of the refugee population, you know, the approximately 5 to 7 million is some of the higher figures I've heard. Folks who are outside of the country who are in the refugee camps are, without exception, opposed to Assad. I'm sure the people who are staying within the areas. Are preferring, I agree with you, are preferring Assad to, you know, to the fear of some of the sectarian fighters in the opposition, who, of course, being sectarian Sunnis, are threatening their lives, you know, as minorities. I think that where we have to think about in turn it is, you know, how do those people not represent and have undue say in the opposition, because I'm sure you would agree that they're not, the opposition is not, you know, all sectarians, that kind of thing. But as far as no Syrian support, as I was talking about, the refugee population, which is one place to start because of its geopolitical destabilizing, you know, crisis right now.
And Otto, you were going to say what? I'm sorry?
I was just going to say that we really lied to the Russians. The West lied. The agreement was that we will not topple Gaddafi. We may move him away, but we will not kill him. And then we killed him, and we said it was an accident. So they really were sort of betrayed, if you could use such word in politics. and that was their experience. It was a very terrible experience. And there was eggs on their face.
And did I hear you trying to jump in here, Tabit, a minute ago?
No. It's, you know, just a minor point that... The main leveraging point that Russia has after the collapse of the Soviet Union and after the chaos that it went through is, one, its vast reserves of natural gas and petroleum, and this is an important part of its economy, and the other is its military might. And it's using its military might to try and shift the balance a bit toward its favor after feeling the United States really squeezing Russia, especially after the events in Chechnya and so forth. There is widespread belief among Russians that U.S. intentions are to really destroy their country, not just, you know, that they're not satisfied with what happened with the collapse of the Soviet Union, that their intention is to destroy Russia itself. And, you know, what happened in Chechnya and so forth only amplified that. And therefore, the Russians are using their last two cards, the military and their control over their gas resources, to right that balance. And I think for them, Syria is a red line, and they will pursue that very aggressively.
Sean.
So one thing that confuses me about the framing that we have of the situation, and I think we sort of take it for granted, is we're talking about the U.S. and Russia as if they're on opposite sides of it. I don't see that on the ground. I mean, if we look at, there's been pushes and critique of Russia, I think quite mild considering like what they've been backing, quite mild considering what Assad has been doing. But, the U.S. has been essentially, I would say the U.S. has sort of turned, if you look at the last couple of years, Obama has, there's been sort of mild criticism, but for the most part, Obama has sort of entrusted Syria to Russia. And because of domestic U.S. concerns, this is something that we all need to deal with, because the U.S. has, U.S. population has been primarily concerned with ISIS, which is a quite small part of the conflict, having responsibility for, you know, something like 3% or 5% of civilian casualties, as opposed to 95% or so from the Assad regime. We've let ourselves be manipulated into prioritizing the fight against ISIS, which I think is really kind of a decoy, and in essence giving a green light to Assad's ethnic cleansing of his own country. So we've been on the same side. The U.S. has been on the same side as Russia in that, you know, there's been no confrontation. Even with the Assad regime, the one time, the U.S. only supports opposition groups that vow to only fight ISIS. And if they fight, if they fight Assad forces, they have their weapons withdrawn. They have their funding withdrawn. We saw the one time that U.S. airstrikes I don't know their intentions, but the one time that U.S. airstrikes targeted Assad troops earlier this year, there was an apology issued, which is striking considering what the U.S. does in the Middle East, doesn't apologize much, and there was monetary recompense to the families. And we've seen, even in opposition areas, when civilians have been killed by the hundreds by U.S. action, we haven't seen anything of the sort. So I think we have to question de facto, even if the U.S. early on, you know, has been asking Assad to step down, in what meaningful sense is the U.S. on the other side from Russia?
Before we have to take a break here, which we have to do in a few minutes, we can talk about your book and your talk tonight. one of the things that you just posited, that Sean posited, Talbot, I mean, it seems to me that part of it has to do with the fact that the U.S. hands are tied in this sense.
I don't disagree with what Sean said, actually.
Go ahead.
I think that when the conflict first erupted, I think they were truly on different sides. The U.S. Openly declared that its intentions were to overthrow the Assad regime, and Russia stepped in very forcefully to protect this regime. I think over time, the United States has yielded. And this is what I meant by the United States has failed in creating a unipolar world. It failed in its original goal of overthrowing the Assad regime and has indeed yielded to Russian-Iranian attempts to bolster the Assad government, but I don't think the Russians will be successful. By the way, I mean I think they will, and in this regard, I agree with Sean that this is not going to be the end of the conflict with Assad emerging victorious and controlling the whole country. I think that the atrocities that he committed have now. It's no longer just, you know, the Assad regime being oppressive and you have to watch what you say and so forth. No, now it has committed atrocities on a wide scale, and I don't think that his regime will be accepted ever, or acquiesced to, or even feared. And I think that this conflict is going to drag on for many, many more years. Perhaps not in the form of moving armies as we see now, but I doubt that the Assad regime will be able to secure the country.
I think you're probably very right about that. Let's get some quick final thoughts on this, and Adel, and then we'll finish off here with Sean.
I think Russia is going to lose in the end. I don't know, a decade or two or three. It's going to be primarily because of their economy. Their economy, again, for the same reason the Soviet Union collapsed, cannot sustain large military power within their border and sending them outside. They will just get bankrupt all over again, and this time is going to be worse than before from internal strifes. So in the long run, but that's 20, 30 years from now.
And Sean, final thought?
I absolutely agree with both what Thabit and Adil have said about this. And I think, you know, also everybody has to remember that Assad at this point is relying on some figures I've heard were about four-fifths or five-sixths of his troops are sectarian fighters from neighboring countries. It's, you know, the majority. I actually have a friend who just published an article. I have a website on this, by the way, SyriaSources.org, and I have this article up on there. A friend of mine was a defector from the army, and it's, you know, a lot of Syrians are running away for years from the sources. He's relying on foreign occupying forces, really, at this point to stay in power.
Lebanese, Iraqi,
Iranian. Afghani, forcibly conscripted. So, you know, that's not sustainable in terms of cost. I couldn't agree more. One thing I kind of wanted to end with in terms of, like, what is it that we do? I don't have an easy answer for that, but I do think it's interesting how we talk about it. I'm a professor. I have my degree in discourse analysis, and I think it's interesting the way that we decide these questions often. And I don't think this is true of my colleagues that we're talking with today, but I think in general when we discuss these things like intervention, yes or no, get decided before we actually talk about the details. So I think something that's interesting, I wrote my first book on the conflicts in former Yugoslavia. I spent 10 years often on there. And I think it's interesting that nobody in the U.S. kind of makes distinctions between, for example, the 1994-5 intervention in Bosnia and the 1999 intervention in Kosovo. I actually strongly oppose the intervention that happened in 1999 around Kosovo and support the one that happened in Bosnia. The one in Bosnia targeted only military targets. It was under the auspices of the United Nations. The estimates I've heard is that it resulted in maybe like 20, 25 casualties. And it brought a war to an end that had killed hundreds of thousands of people. When I traveled in that region, in Banja Luka, Bosnia, and I was asking civilians their memories of it, nobody remembered that intervention. They didn't even know that it happened. They remembered the war and that it ended. And so I think and then as opposed to the Kosovo intervention where, you know, NATO took out infrastructure hundreds and hundreds of miles away, punished the whole population, had still some hundreds of casualties, but wreaked, you know, economic devastation on the whole region for generations to come. And it's sort of unforgivable and was about the stupidest thing you could do. Also, it cost 90 years of the GDP of Kosovo to do what they did in terms of cruise missiles and everything. And I just think that there's a lot better thing you can do for that. So what's interesting to me is that we in the West don't care about that distinction. I never hear people make distinction between those two things. It's either like intervention, yes, we have to go do something, or like, yeah, we can go take care of that situation, or intervention, no, because the Iraq war and Vietnam. And it's interesting to me that we don't kind of talk about the details of that. I understand that, I mean, I've been organizing against U.S. militarism for 30 years, so I understand the suspicion of it, but I think it's important for us to draw the discussion onto what are the details. And I think there's certainly tons of stuff that we could do at all sorts of levels as citizens, potentially as a state, whatever, to, without triggering World War III, I think that's like kind of a decoy way to change the topic, make sure we have a bottom line that you just can't treat civilians like this. And there's international, you know, consequences for doing this, and it's just unacceptable. I think we can do that while still, obviously, Russia's going to have a part to play in the future of Syria and Iran, and, you know, bring everybody to the table, but not make those negotiations through the bodies of hundreds of thousands of Syrians.
And Tabat Nadal, unless you have something glaring you want to say.
The humanitarian intervention, which Sean is talking about, I would be for it if it was not infiltrated by colonization and real invasion and killing people. That's the problem. We use a humanitarian intervention to hide all these other interventions in it. I think it's the wrong thing to do through the naming of a humanitarian intervention. I do not want them, even if people are bad dictator, etc. The only reason I'm favoring it a little bit in Syria, because the situation of devastation and hunger and slaughter is such a degree that intervention, no matter how bad it is better than what now.
So
I don't disagree with what Sean said. In general, the people of the Middle East are much more suspicious of Western intervention, no matter how it's done, than any other region in the entire world, and for very, very good reasons. But there are cases. I mean, right now the American assistance in Mosul is generally popular in Iraq.
I'm with you. I'm with it.
Yeah. So, but I agree. I agree with what Ada said. The people of the region are less receptive to any kind of Western intervention than would be the case, say, in the Balkans or anywhere else in the world. Still, it's not an impossible thing. It could be done.
I want to thank the three of you. This has been a fascinating discussion. Really, one of the, not just because it's on our show, but one of the best I've heard around Syria in a long, long time. Dr. Tabat Abdallah, Associate Professor of Middle East History, Dr. Adil Shamu, Associate Fellow in the Institute of Policy Studies. Thank you both so much. It's always great to have the two of you on the air with us. It means a great deal. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Sean McFessel, also, I want to thank you very much for being here for this.